Tonight on Arena, Frawaka, the friend, and the accountant too are our films for review, and Paddy Hannah plays live in studio. You can text us on 51551 or on X at RTE Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. Tonight on Arena's film reviews, we've Spooky Rituals, A Woman's Best Friend, and What Everyone Needs, A Second Accountant. In The Friend, Naomi Watts plays a New York intellectual who inherits a depressed Great Dane. Ben Affleck is back with the second installment of his action film, The Accountant. This time, the star of The Bear, John Bernthal, is in tow. And I'm joined in studio by Cara O'Doherty and Hilary White, who have been to the cinema for us. You're both very welcome. The first this evening, we'll talk about Frawaka, the new Irish language folk horror film starring Claire Munnelly and Brigid Nocton as a woman with dementia and her carer who develop a creepy bond. Hilary, the writer-director Aisling Clark was in with us earlier in the week along with Claire Munnelly, and Aisling spoke about how steep the narrative is in those spooky stories and traditions that we were all brought up in, and bring us into the story and how they use those myths and scary stories.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you said that, because I think one of the great things about this film is that it's also rooted in a very real Ireland. I mean, she weaves in elements of clerical abuse even into this. We are in a modern Ireland, ostensibly. There is a tragedy in a dingy attic loft, and then during a period of time later, a young same-sex couple move in. This is Shu, played by Claire Munnelly, as you said, and her very pregnant Ukrainian partner, played by Alexandra Bershitskaya. And just as they're sort of settling in and deciding what goes where and putting away things, Shu gets called out to a very remote village in Ireland. She is a carer, and she has been assigned to quite a sizable country house on the fringes of the village, up a sort of, you know, country back lane, where an elderly lady, Peg, played by Brigid Nocton, as you mentioned there, is having delusions, is having visions, is very paranoid. And at the start, she's incredibly wary of Shu, incredibly wary of an outside presence. And then a sort of a trust is built and a softening.
Well, let's listen to one of the scenes where Claire Munnelly, as Shu, arrives at Peg's house, but doesn't get a warm welcome. Brigid Nocton is Peg.
Hello? A Vanicky Lavrija? Fuck!
You'll miss a hanulig in the stack, come I say, come good deed or KO Hain.
Her primary care on Shaw, May. Fake. She might be. Bulti Karklor?
Shin Moon!
Ugh.
Hey.
A rather unsavoury welcome there from Peg for Shu. Cara, how does Aisling Clark create this supernatural menace in the house and outside?
Well, there's two things. One thing is Dee Hexon's extraordinary sound score, which is absolutely haunting and just really sets a tone for something that is just not right here. But also there's just little nods everywhere. In the house, there's a door that the peg doesn't open, and she has all sorts of different superstitious things around it. There's nails, there's horseshoes, all these little things. But throughout the house itself, which the house really becomes a character in the film, it's full of all these sort of dark and kind of creepy little things that by themselves are interesting little curios, but put them together with the soundtrack and with the fact that we know something is going on maybe underneath the house, it just adds to this really just creepy sense of this place is just not right.
And what's going on then between the two women? That's where it gets very, it's not clear, but yes, it makes it quite intriguing.
Yeah, it's one of the delectable things about this film is that you have somebody who is on medication, then it turns out there's actually two people on medication. And so there's this wonderful kind of tension between are these people not taking enough medication? Have they forgotten their medication? Or are they actually, is there some sort of presence that is going on in the house? And then as we get further into the undergrowth of the story, there are links then, and there's an interplay between the past and the present. There's a conversation begins those two things.
Yeah, let's listen to another clip. Here Shu gets the lowdown on Peg, who was played by Brittany Nocton, from Maeve, a local woman, and she's played by Dorothy Duffy.
Is Cass special to Ian Van Hoos?
No more on Anna, are there?
Jerther Groshi Ashta Agoni. Agoraphobia is Castle. Bishigyondin Atiha Magdalene Blaintohan. Shinan Rodda Jerther.
Mavlana Vekion.
Bishishinner Fad Riv Maamsa. Is she melting and doyer chayshid ladini? And Troshin.
Am I out, Maeve?
So Cara, she brings up there, Maeve, this neighbour of Shoes, brings up the fact that they think that the Peg character had been in a Magdalen laundry. She's not too sure whether there was a child involved. So it ties it, as Hilary said, into that whole history of Ireland and clericalism.
Absolutely. And there's also Peg has this wonderful, almost a monologue about a dream that she has. And she refers to a lot of the traumas that Ireland has experienced, particularly the women of Ireland, and those things that haven't really been investigated, haven't been explored. So there's a lot of references hidden to intergenerational trauma. And both women have suffered in the past. And Shu had a difficult upbringing. So as Hilary says, we're not really sure what if this is of her making, what's in her mind, or what is influenced by what happened when she was young. So it really looks, it mixes that idea of folklore, of tradition and history and trauma, and it does it so neatly.
Now, Hilary, folk horror is quite a thing now. We had Midsummer, we've had The Witch. But it's interesting that more Irish filmmakers aren't exploring the genre.
Yeah, I always wonder this. I mean, I see films like Starvaker last year. You mentioned The Witch, Midsummer. It's a really rich brand of horror, I always think. It makes great use of the landscape around the characters. It makes great use of arcane traditions and of heritage that has been subsumed by something more modern and maybe less sort of sensitive. And I always wonder why, you know, in a country with such deeply rooted folklore, with this very traumatic past, with organized religion, and with this, you know, a real brand of rural weirdness, which is still out there, I must say, I don't know why we're not, you know, world leaders in folk art. But maybe this, you know, superb film might be a turning of the ship on that front.
Superb film. So do you think it works overall, Cara, and how many stars?
Absolutely. I mean, horror isn't for everyone. I'm not a huge horror fan. What I love about this is that there's a solid story behind it. There's a reason for everything that happens. And the dynamic between the two characters, between Peg and Shu, is so wonderfully done by Brittany Octon and Claire Monnelly. It's 4 stars. It really is. It's a solid, solid, scary film.
And Hilary, you seem to be very engaged by it.
Yeah, I'm the same. I think so many horror films, they all do this thing where they completely unravel in the final 20 minutes and you lose any of the tension and good work that's been done. I thought there was incredible control in this film, like right up to the end. And any of the chills that are there in the start of the film, they're compounded as the film goes on. So yeah, I was really impressed with this, and it's 4 stars from me.
Four stars from both of you for Frey Waka. Now, next we have The Friends, starring Naomi Watts and Bill Murray. It's a film about a brainy New Yorkers in small apartments. Cara, tell us who Iris is and how does she come to be responsible for a truly enormous dog?
Iris is, she's a literature lecturer, she's a writer, but she has sort of taken a sabbatical from her own writing and her own career to be an editor on a book by Bill Murray, who Walter, a much loved but also problematic professor and writer. And it is not a spoiler to say that at the very start of this, something happens involving Walter that means Iris must take ownership, or temporary ownership, of this Great Dane who is literally, he's a monster, and she's to bring him home to her small but beautiful New York apartment. The problem is she is not a dog person. The building doesn't allow pets. It also isn't the right size for a Great Dane. But the biggest thing of all is that Apollo is very, very sad. He misses his owner terribly. And as Iris is not a dog person, she can't really connect. And she can't figure out how do you help a grieving dog? But also she's grieving as well. So they have to try and sort of muddle through.
Yes, because she's a friend of Walter, but there was also a romantic connection there.
Maybe. Possibly.
Possibly. Yes. But he had a lot of other romantic connections.
Walter was famous for his affairs. He had three wives. His ex-wives are all in this and they all bring a very funny dynamic. One of them is sort of sitting back and looking at this happening. Another one is jealous that she didn't get the dog, even though she didn't want the dog. It's the principle of the thing. And his now widow just didn't want the dog in the first place. So there's this really funny dynamic as these three other women sit back and look at this one woman who is now left to sort of clean up Walter's mess through Apollo the dog.
Now we have a short clip from the trailer. It's Walter's wife Barbara, played by Norma Domazzoweni. She tells Iris, the Naomi Watts character, about her four-legged inheritance.
Iris, I need to talk with you. It's about the dog. I wanted to ask if you could take him.
No, I can't. No.
This is what Walter wanted after he died.
Why would he say that?
You were his best friend.
Now, that's a clip there from The Friend. So, Hilary, people often say you should never act with animals and children. How does Naomi Watts do with this enormous dog?
I thought superbly. I think it'll be one of the most memorable images that I'll probably have in cinema this year is just Naomi Watts being walked by this gigantic Harlequin Great Dane through Washington Square in New York. You'll be pleased to hear that the dog actor Bing has his own IMDb page. And he's got a bright future ahead of him, I must say.
Yes, he's been on all the chat shows.
Absolutely. Call his agent. There's some really beautiful moments in this, and it's one of the great things about having an animal like that, like a centrepiece in this film. I mean, in a sense, he's kind of a MacGuffin. It's almost a film about a dog that's not about the dog, and a film about grief that isn't really talking about grief. But
when it's not about the dog, do you mean it's about the humans?
It's about the people around him. Having a dog of that, you know, of that size in the centre of the thing makes you actually look more closely at the people around him and how he affects them. And I just thought there were some really lovely moments in this film in that really kind of unmannered, you know, getting under the skin way that animals tend to bring to the fray.
So, Cara, it's set in arty, intellectual downtown New York. How is that captured?
Which is somehow affordable to writers.
So, yes, apparently it turns out you can easily afford it. Do you know what? It's gorgeous. There's nothing as nice as watching something in that New York setting. But what I love about this is that it has the humour that we often see in these types of films, but it doesn't have the cynicism. Mm. So it's just this, it's just these beautifully, wonderfully drawn characters. And the apartment itself is so classic New York. It's a rent controlled building that she inherited. So it's this warm space that's full of books. And I mean, if I could leave tomorrow to go to live in New York, that's the apartment I would want to go to. And hopefully it would come with a Great Dane.
And now it's based on a very good book, isn't it, by Sigrid Nunez?
Mm. Yeah, a bestseller. You know, she's quite a senior author in the States, but this is really kind of a breakthrough hit for her in 2018, I believe it came out. And I think in the book, you know, the character of Walter is he's a real devil may care cad. It's slightly more toned down in this. And also it's more a book about, you know, writing and writers. That's kind of the main sort of driver of the thing. But I thought these co-directors and writers, Scott McGee and David Siegel, they did a very good job of just keeping intact that, you know, that really kind of tender, observant, life-affirming.
And something happens, as you said, Cara, to kind of the Bill Murray isn't around. So how much Bill Murray do we get? And do we get a satisfactory amount of Bill Murray?
We get a nice intro to him at the start, and then there's small flashbacks, and his voice is used quite a lot. There's moments that different characters remember at times that he had spoken. In some ways, I would have liked a little bit more Bill Murray, maybe just another scene later on. But at the same time, it's not really about him. It is about Iris and the dog.
That's the friend of the title. It's Iris.
You know. Right, so Iris is the friend.
As I interpreted it anyway.
Yes, and it's how she befriends
Yeah, because by, you know, in taking in this dog who she's been entrusted with, she's actually learning a bit more about her dead friend, her late friend in it. And it's there's something very nice about that package on opening as the film goes on.
So he chooses her, but in return, he, I suppose, you know, continues.
Yeah, and she also has to kind of rehabilitate this dog who is missing his master, you know. So it's
There's
quite a bit going on.
So stars out of five from you, Cara.
Another four here on a roll here. It just shows that bond that dogs and people can have, and a lovely depiction of grief without melodramatic. That's not a word, melodramatifying it. There's a new word for you.
I understand it perfectly. Yeah. You should be with the New York intellectuals.
Exactly.
And from you, Hilary.
I'm really quite shallow. If you've got a dog in a film, it's a star for me. If it's a really big dog, it's getting two stars. And then another two on top of that for what I think is a really agreeable time in the cinema. So four from me.
Four from you. Okay, we'll know how to get stars out of you in the future. Our third and final film this evening is The Accountant 2, with Ben Affleck returning to the role of Christian Wolfe. Cara, what do we need to know about Christian as we approach the second installment?
So we need to know that he is a super mathematician, beyond brilliant. He is autistic, which helps his skill when it comes to maths. He seems to be a regular accountant, but actually he is also working for some of the biggest and baddest cartels around the world. But he's doing it in a Robin Hood style. He takes the money from them and uses it to help a good cause. And he also uses his knowledge to share it with government officials who might be able to then use that information to take out the bad people. So he's got a lot of layers going on. He was also, because this isn't enough, he was also raised to basically be a super soldier with his younger brother Brax, played by John Bernthal. Their father wants to make sure that the autism was never going to mean that Christian will be bullied. So he's this very complicated, multi-layered character. And at the end of the last film, the two brothers had reunited, but this is set 8 years later and they haven't seen each other in quite some time.
Okay, so what is the premise here of this film? I mean, that was so much information you gave us, Cara, and so much information that the film had to give us.
Yeah. So, if, like, from the get-go, we are into this world of, you know, Latin American bad guys with scarred faces, so we know we're in that kind of cartel world. A character from the previous film, Raymond, played by J.K. Simmons, is having a shady meeting in a public bar, and it ends in a shootout. It ends in a key death, and on the body of the dead person is written a note saying, "Find the accountant," which is obviously Christian. The message gets to US Treasury Deputy Director Medina, played by Cynthia Adey Robinson. She tracks down Christian, who is living this life of sort of, you know, monastic perfection in a caravan in a parking lot somewhere. And the two of them kind of team up to sort of follow the paper trail, and it leads it to this conspiracy of, you know, smuggled migrant workers, a smuggling route across the border. Mm-hmm. And then they realise what they're up against, and Christian ends up enlisting the help of his brother Brax.
Okay, and I have a clip of Christian and his brother Brax talking about dogs.
Oh.
So here, in this more relaxed scene than what you've been describing to me, Christopher, played by Ben Affleck, and John Bernthal, plays Brax, and they discuss the virtues of cats versus dogs.
I'd like to have someone check in on.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, get a dog.
Do you have a dog?
I'm getting a dog. Look at this. Yeah. That's Greg.
Unconvincing.
What do you mean unconvincing? That's Greg. I'm getting this dog.
No, you like the idea of a dog.
Anybody who has a dog likes the idea of getting a dog. It's why they got the dog in the first place.
Do you have a permanent residence?
No.
Anyone to care for your dog during long absences?
I do not.
Do you keep a regular schedule in terms of eating, sleeping?
I don't.
You're a cat person. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, you know something, if I had a cat, at least the cat would miss me.
Doubtful. Possible.
John Bernthal there as Brax and Ben Affleck as Christopher from The Accountant 2. So they seem to have a lot of chemistry, Cara.
They do. And this is one of the reasons why I loved this film. It's the two of them together. Ben Affleck's character, Christian, finds it hard to communicate. He can't really tell his brother how he feels about him. And after many years apart, Brax, he's an assassin. He's this cold-hearted warrior dude. But he just wants a hug from his brother. He just wants to kind of iron out the issues they had when they were kids. He misses his brother. And there's this very funny moment where he actually makes fun of him for his autism, which on the outside that looks awful. But in the context of the fact that it really affected their childhood, it really kind of it helps Christian in a weird way to navigate a lot of the things that they haven't been able to deal with. And the chemistry is brilliant. And Bernthal has this way of going from sort of cracking jokes to almost breaking your heart with the big tears in his eyes, in this almost like puppy dog eyes. It's the dogs again. He just does this thing where he melts, and he does it so well. And the two of them together, they have just great chemistry.
Now, Hilary, doesn't mm-hmm. that sound wonderful? Mm-hmm. And all the complexity of the plot, and at the heart of it, there's brotherly love.
At the heart of this brotherly love, I, for my money, I thought it got a lot less interesting as soon as John Bernthal's character came into the fray. A character who, I have to say, is the same character that John Bernthal seems to always play. Very jockish, very loud, very chest bumping, but with this sort of tenderness in the middle. And I thought Christian's character was interesting enough. I kind of wanted to delve a bit more deeply into him. I wanted something a bit more like, I don't know, maybe the Michael Fassbender film, The Killer, just something where you get a really deep character study into a different type of contract killer. And I found that I was just sort of watching a kind of a chalk and cheese action comedy, one of these sort of buddy things. And I just found the whole thing very unmemorable, very tepid. And while, you know, it is very plotty and it's very, you know, there's a lot of forward momentum in it, and these are good things. But I just found in a 132-minute film, there's far too much plot. I found those characters, key characters, disappearing for large tracts of time, only to suddenly pop back up again. You're going, who are they again? And why are they so important? And just by the end of it, I was going to warn out.
Yeah. I have to admit, it has a fair few plot holes. There are some things that don't really make any sense. But the chemistry between the two of them, and I have to disagree now with Hilary, especially when it comes to Bernthal. I think he brings a lot of nuance to his tender moments. But I really think, and there's this wonderful moment where Christian, he wants to meet a girl, and he does it by recognizing the rhythm of the line dancing. And gets up, and whoever thought we'd see Ben Affleck line dancing in the middle of an action film? So for moments like that, plus the final act, there for somebody like me who loves action sequences, there is an epic last act. I won't go into spoilers. I can see Hilary completely looking at me. I'm not agreeing at all, Hilary. But that final act, just as a girl who likes shoot 'em ups, I tell you, it worked for me.
We're going to have separate apartments in New York. I just want to say that. It didn't. I found this film just became more and more conventional. I quite liked the first film. I thought the premise is very interesting. I thought the character is very interesting. I think Ben Affleck's performance was very good. This sort of dry, clipped enunciation that he has. A very analytical character. But I just found by sort of the third act, by the start of the third act, I could have been watching, I don't know, Bad Boys or something. It just felt very formulaic, very by numbers. And I didn't give it a second's thought after the credits rolled.
God, very different points of view on that. Cara, stars out of 5 for you.
I'm bracing myself now as I do this. But for a film that doesn't make
sense. He's more disappointed than going to fight you, I think.
I am giving this 4 stars for being an absolutely wild, entertaining romp. And sometimes that is just what you need in life.
You need in life, Hilary.
If this film had a great day, I would give it 4 stars. Unfortunately, this is a 2 out of 5 for me.
Well, if only they'd known. 2 out of 5 and 4 out of 5. That's for The Accountant 2. My thanks to Cara O'Doherty and Hilary White. The Accountant, The Friend and Free Walker all go on general release in cinemas this weekend. Irish musician Paddy Hannah has released his highly anticipated fifth album, Islegate, named after a town outside Wexford where Paddy was living at the time of writing. Before we talk about the album, let's begin with some music. Paddy, and your song, Harry Dean. Can you tell us a little about this song?
Well, thank you for having me. And it's a song about sort of moving on and leaving the past behind you in the purest possible terms. And I hope that you, those of you listening at home, can associate or feel that in some way or another. I hope you enjoy it. The song is called Harry Dean.
Oh, I know I can see you somehow gone. Promised you the world in a different song. It will hurt to be leaving, but stay strong. Life won't be the same, but we'll struggle on. Carry me, Harry Dean. I know it might seem dramatic now, but we'll see it someday. Harry Dean. Oh, I know it might seem dramatic now, but we'll see it someday. Harry Dean. I'll save up my money, won't last long. Sold my last guitar to keep the lights on. Will we look out the window one last time? If you won't be the same without you by my side. Carry me, Harry Dean. I know it might seem dramatic now, but we'll see it someday. Oh, I know it might seem dramatic now, but we'll see it someday. Harry Dean. Oh, I know it might seem dramatic now, but we'll see it someday.
That was Harry Dean there, performed by Paddy Hannah. And Paddy Hannah's new album is called Islegate. Talk to us about the name Islegate first, Paddy. How did it get its name? Because it's important to this whole process of writing this new album.
It is. And I want to, first of all, credit my wife, Jilly, for coming up with the idea of calling the album Islegate. Originally, I wanted to call the album Tucson, Arizona, funnily enough, which is a song that I'll be playing shortly. But she is a designer and a very good one at that. And she basically said two things. First of all, Oilgate would look rather beautiful on a vinyl or on a record sleeve in terms of typography and whatnot. And second of all, you've been to Oilgate, sir, several times. You've never been to Tucson, Arizona. And so therefore, it has far more artistic relevance. So thank you, Jilly, for being the smarter of the two of us.
Right, but something did happen to you at Oilgate Station. Is that right? Petrol station?
Yes, there's a rather lovely petrol station that is adjacent to a beautiful thatched kind of house. And this is going to sound a little peculiar, but I did pull over there one time to get gas or something like that. And I found myself at this bizarre intersection that many of us get to in our life, where it's the metaphorical and literal crossroads of, you know, do you throw it all away? Do you run away? Do you go left when you should be going right? You know, and all these sorts of things. And in a strange way, and still to this day, every time I am in Oilgate, I feel it is a bizarrely cosmic sensation that the place elicits in me. That and PJ's Diner, which is a very fabulous diner. But yes, on a bizarre cosmic level, the Oilgate station is some sort of it is a place where I just.
But the result was a good one. Well, you know, whatever cosmic questions were thrown at you, you decided to go for it and go back to music. And Oilgate is the result.
Yeah, that's essentially what happened. I mean, when it came to making this record, without my family, this record does not exist. You know, they held me up. They said, "Paddy, we're not letting you quit." And I fully intended to completely discard any and all evidence that I'd ever made music, to not embarrass myself to my kids when they were older and stuff like that. And it just was like that they saw that, like, you know, Paddy, this isn't you.
And encouraged you. Now, that track, Harry Dean, that we've just heard, and there's something either between worlds or otherworldly about it. And this was brought about by long periods of enforced insomnia and watching Soviet-style Russian science fiction films. Could you tell us about that kind of trance state that created some of the songs on Oilgate?
Well, insomnia is a hell of a thing. You know, I tend to have trouble sleeping anyways. And when the little ones showed up, sleep was just a concept at that point, you know. And so basically, with my family's encouragement, I sat down to try and write what would become this record. And I had no choice. I had to write through the fatigue and also through the depressive haze that I was in. So in order to do that, I just one night, completely randomly, whilst writing in a state of exhaustion, I pressed play on a video of a Russian movie called Solaris from 1972. And I just hit the mute button and started playing piano. And it's something about that movie, I don't know, some little magical little thing happened where I suddenly lost myself in the eyes of the actors. And it's a very expressive film. The beauty of the cinematography, I'm not going to say it was like a magical moment, but it was just a moment where I rose above the depressive haze and the exhausted state that I was in, and I was able to function as a writer for the first time in quite a period, you know. So as I say to anyone going through any kind of mental health struggle, or indeed someone dealing with, you know, the exhaustion of being a parent, it's certainly not a cure-all, but it's, I mean, if you are trying to express yourself, I mean, certainly it's worth giving a go. Whether it works is an entirely different thing.
And of course, Solaris was created by another poet, Tarkovsky. So there's symmetry there. Then you worked with Daniel Fox, the producer, and you asked him to create something that had the sensation of sweet, sweet caramel.
Yes. So I really have an affinity for synthesizers, and in particular, or just keyboards in general. I mean, I'm a bit hippie-ish in this regard. I think an instrument that's been around for, say, 40-odd years on some level has a story to tell. When you place your fingers upon the keys, it's almost as if you can feel previous life experiences channeling through you. And that is, when making the sounds that you hear on this record, we made a real point of trying to bring out the warm, inviting tone of a beautiful synthesizer. And in this case, it was a Juno synthesizer lent to us by a wonderful fellow called Al Duggan. And we spent a lot of time really trying to tweak the sounds on the synthesizer. So when you listen to the record, as I mentioned, I wanted to sound like sweet, sweet caramel.
Right, and sweet, sweet caramel, and also that otherworldly sensation.
It couldn't not sound otherworldly, the record. It's so strange because it wasn't my intention to sound otherworldly, but it couldn't not sound otherworldly. It's just, and of course, Daniel as a producer completely lent into this idea that I was writing through exhaustion and taking any kind of inspiration from Russian science fiction movies with the sound off. You know, he's a wonderful producer in that regard. He leans into this, to what one might call crazy. A lesser talent would have said, what you're doing sounds completely bonkers. Let's not do that. But he was the total opposite.
Now, let's jump from Isle Gate to Tucson, Arizona. Introduce the next track for us, Paddy.
Thank you. This song is called Tucson, Arizona, the original title of the record. And it's a song about grief and love and whatnot. And I hope that you enjoy it.
I have loved you on first sight, as we gathered for the phoenix light. When the sanctum you came alive, couldn't bear to tell you she had died. I have known you for all, seen your face upon the darkest sky. At the 5140 East Speedway, my blood became your lemonade. Tucson, Arizona, look back to the night. Tucson, Arizona, I'll wait for the bye. I will love till you're gone, so lonely by the blackened hill. No apple brandy can I change your bye-bye blackbird serenade. I will love you one last time in the shadow. Let the big star come and take us both. Together we can be as dust. Tucson, Arizona, look back to the night. Tucson, Arizona, I'll wait for the bye. I'll wait for the bye.
That was Tucson, Arizona, performed there by Paddy Hannah. That's one of the tracks on Paddy Hannah's new album, Islegate. And you can see Paddy play in festivals when next we meet on June the 8th and Beyond the Pale on June the 14th. Paddy Hannah Music on Instagram is where you'll get all that information. Paddy, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Actor Rose Henderson takes on the title role of Kitty Clogg in The Good Crank, a new stage show from Seitner Sound Theatre Company, currently on tour in Dublin. Kitty lives by herself in Single Street, the oldest street in Galway City. She's on her own since her husband Henry vanished, leaving a note to say gone fishing. But she is surrounded by an eccentric cast of characters, including neighbours Phyllis Quirk and Jack Lawless. Directed by Goretti Slaven, The Good Crank is a one-woman show, so Rose Henderson has plenty to do. And it's written by Galway author Alan McMonagall, and Alan and Rose join me in studio. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Alan, you've written novels, short stories and radio plays. The Good Crank began as a short story from your collection, The Psychotic Episodes. Was it a matter of time before you turned it into a stage play?
Yes, is the short answer. It began as a short story. It was 2,000 words of hijinks, attitude and haughtiness and the keen eye on the absurd, and a character who was determined not to go quietly into that good night, shall we say. Myself and director Craddy Slaven, we've collaborated on a number of radio plays together, some of which have been broadcast on RTE's Drama On One slot. And she read the story and she liked it. She saw a few things in it. And she thought it might make for a piece that would be very transferable to the stage.
So tell us, for you, who was Kitty Clogg?
Well, Kitty, she began as a voice. I mean, as I said, the 2,000 word short story, I didn't realise it was a woman until I had finished it. And a woman of a certain age, shall we say, a woman who has been knocking around for long enough for life to have gotten its hooks into her. Yeah, she's full of attitude. There's a level of haughtiness. She doesn't give her friendship easily. It's hard won, but once it is won, it's there for keeps, I think. She's got a keen eye on the absurd. There's a lurking vulnerability there as well, I think, and that speaks to this absence in her life, this man, Henry, who was here one day, gone the next, and without so much as a thank you for the memories. So that gets her going off on a quest, an odyssey, to find him.
To find him, indeed. And Rose, Kitty Clogg is the good crank. What do you think? Why is she a crank? And what is a crank?
Well, life has made her into a crank, I think. I think she probably was a crank before Henry left. But she's a good complainer, let's say. So she's not the kind of person who would take a rare steak when she'd ask for it to be medium rare. So she's very certain about what she wants and what should happen. So she writes complaining letters. She gets 5x7 index cards and sends them all off. So when her man leaves, it bejazzles her. She just can't believe it, because he would have always told her where he was going. Now, he might disappear off because he's a fisherman, but never just for this long or for this huge absence. So it's just turned her in on herself, and she's frantic to try and find him.
Now, she's not alone in life. She has two neighbours. Could you describe the neighbours at either side of her?
Yeah, so her neighbour to the right, Phyllis Quirk, who she calls Phyllis Quirk always. She never calls her Phyllis. she is grateful to her, because she does come and keep her company. And Phyllis makes her own wine, which isn't always great, but she makes a quantity of it, and they sit out the back and they compare notes about what's been going on. And Jack Lawless on the other side is a just one of those people who are up at the window all the time watching the comings and goings. He can hear everything. He can see everything. He knows everything. And he has this lust, really, for Kitty, for anything he can get from her. And she's just trying to peel him off her all the time.
Now, Alan, there was a great description of Single Street at the beginning and about the men who live on the street.
Is it Blind Matty and Deaf Tim, or vice versa? I get them the wrong way around myself at times.
How did you conjure up this street where all these characters live?
It's old Galway, the old part of town there, just back of the Cladda. There's an old street. It's actually called Henry Street, where Kitty's man gets his name from. And it's a street I pass on my walk into town on a regular basis. I know a few people who live on this street, and they're characters, they're eccentrics, they're oddballs in the most delightful way, and they tell great stories about their neighbours who are similarly eccentric and quirky. And these were two of the guys that, it was just a line I think I overheard once upon a time, a long, long time ago. It gets in the notebook and eventually gets used.
Yes, the needs of one are usually compensated by the other.
That's right. Yeah. Between the two of them, you know, they'll be on the high stools in their local and they'll be solving everything. And between the two, one can hear and one can see. So, yeah, they reckon they have the complete picture, the entirety of everything between the two of them.
Now, that's enough. Now, for Kitty, Rose, Phyllis and Jack, keep an eye out for her, for good mainly, even though they might have their ulterior motives at times. And maybe they're not very sympathetic to the fact that her husband has disappeared. Whereas in her life, she really believes that she needs to know why, and she sets out on an odyssey.
Yeah. So she's determined to. I mean, I think it suits her better to feel that he's run away. So she doesn't know, but it's an easier thing to grasp onto that he's off with somebody else. So she heads off on her bicycle to find him. And it's a beautifully written piece, but she just is determined, and she looks in all their old haunts and she asks everybody she knows, where is he? And she knows, somebody knows.
Yes, and I think, is it Phyllis has already given her some advice about where she might go, Alan?
That's right, yeah. Phyllis's, her superstitions kick in, and she is constantly sending Kitty either towards Gypsy Teresa, a soothsayer, and or towards a certain fig tree growing out at the top end of the canal that has, shall we say, certain properties that Kitty would be, well, according to Phyllis anyway, well advised to embrace.
Now, Rose, you're going to perform a piece from the play, and this is on this odyssey that she's going west.
Yes, so she's on her hunt for the man, for Henry. I ask after him in all the usual places, of all the usual suspects. Never heard of him? Says one. What's it worth to you? Tries another. A chancer out of Moyard, who isn't long backing down when I offer him a technical description of the bacon slicer I am dying to try out. And soon the tables are reversed, and the questions are coming thick and fast at me. What does he look like? Have you got a photograph? Did he have a brother who fell in love with the trapeze women in Fawcett Circus? No, no, no! And then, I knew a Henry once. This from a lad out of Glinsk with foxtrot eyes and an alligator smile. Did he like boats? I asked this fellow, scarcely able to contain my excitement. No, he liked stripping down to his underpants and shooting darts at the wind. Oh, were the underpants canary yellow Y fronts? I ask. No, they were a paler shade of green and had more holes in them than a Swiss cheese. Not my Henry, so.
Very good. That's actor Rose Henderson there playing Kitty Clogg from the play The Good Crank, written by Alan McMonagall. Rose, we see you there taking on all these voices, and you also do the voice of Phyllis and Jack.
Yes.
So how did you, presumably with Gretty and Alan, create all these different people? Because you have to be so sorry, you have to establish Kitty for us and then populate the play with others.
Yeah, so Kitty is effectively telling the story, and a lot of these people are in her head, don't forget. So she, but we trawled through the script trying to find, well, picking out the voices, choosing the voices first, and then we went physically at it and said, well, what do they look like, and what's one kind of characteristic that each of them have, or where exactly on the stage do we find them? So that kind of helps the audience when they're watching, oh, here comes Jack Lawless and here comes Phyllis. And the difficulty was that they often talk to each other. So Phyllis and Kitty are having their wine at the back, and Kitty is holding the wine, Phyllis is not holding the wine, Kitty is giving out, Phyllis is very kind, generous, and then Phyllis has broken her arm, so she's got a very weird arm, and then she breaks her leg later on, so she's got an arm and a leg. So
it was very weird being around you, Rose, during the making of this play.
So physically we had to be so precise, so not to anticipate a new character that's coming in and just to wait until they come in. So that's how it is. It has to be very precise.
Driven that poor woman over the edge, Alan.
It's good though, because, you know, like, it's because it accommodates so many different voices. It's a piece that, though it's a one woman show, a one person piece, it becomes more than just mere monologue. You know, it's performance, interaction. It's a very dynamic piece.
And now you were talking there about the street in Galway that you plucked a few of your characters from, and you performed this show in Galway at the Galway Theatre Festival. Were you nervous?
I was pretty nervous, yeah. It had its premiere at last year's Galway Theatre Festival over the May Bank Holiday weekend, and we'd pretty much two full houses, and there is an audience like a Galwegian audience, I think, that will quickly let you know if they're not seeing their patch presented in a manner they feel it ought to be presented. So, yeah, that provided plenty of nerves, but there was a couple of lovely moments post-show. A couple of people came up to us and spoke about the summer sequence when Kitty is on her odyssey into Connemara to look for her vanished man. A typical line that vanished Henry would have given her would be, "I'm going out for a few minutes, I'll see you later." She won't see him until the end of summer. So the spirit of that, it's very Galway, and some of the audience mentioned this, which was good to hear.
Yes, what was it like for you, Rose?
It was great, because I don't really know all these places. So I had to pretend I did, as if I was bringing them around the country lane. So it was wonderful. Nothing like just being very confident.
I think the thing about it, as well as its humour, like, it is great that this spotlight is on older people. Most of the people on this street, including Rose and her two neighbours, are older. But yet, your character. Kitty is full of passion.
She's
out for looking for her man because she loves her man,
yes,
and she misses her man, and she's lonely.
They had so much together, and actually, of all the voices that she has in her head, when he speaks, she doesn't put on a voice. It's as if they are one. So I think that's lovely that you know, and that's why she goes to the trouble of finding him, because she loved him, and that's the heart of it.
Well, Rose Henderson and Alan McMonagall, thank you so much for talking to us about Alan's play, The Good Crank. It's at the Purty Kitchen, Dunleary, tomorrow night on the 25th of April, at the Viking Theatre, Clontarf, from the 28th of April to the 10th of May, the Civic Theatre in Tala, the 12th to the 16th of May, Smock Alley Theatre, Dublin, the 20th, 24th of May. It also tours to the Backstage Theatre in Longford on the 14th of June, and Cork Arts Theatre from the 6th to the 9th of August. Further details at Seidner Sound on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, just to remind you before we go, that early in May, we're going to host the launch of a new album by the great traditional music innovators, Kila, with a special live show in Studio One in the RT Radio Centre. In this latest album, they are merging their traditional Irish music roots with an 8-piece brass section, Paul Frost Brass. So if you'd like to join us in Studio One for the launch of the new album Raise the Road from Kila and Brass at 7 p.m. on Tuesday the 6th of May, send us an email to arena@rte.ie with Kila in the subject line. And join us tomorrow on Arena when we'll be reviewing three new TV series, Etoile, Andor Season 2 and Penelope. And in albums we've been listening to, Stereophonics, Willie Nelson and Self-Esteem. That's it for tonight's show. Paula Shields researched. Tommy O'Sullivan and James Feeney were on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next.